Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Zingari. Last Wednesday, we did our quarterly book show. We had a couple of guests who gave us a ton of great suggestions on books of all sorts for you to check out. Today is a book show of a different sort. At 10, we're going to meet Jason Broughton, who is Vermont's first African-American state librarian. But this hour, we're going to talk to an author from Verscher, who is also a reporter for the Valley News. You've heard me mention this book several times on the air in the last month as I was reading it. The book is titled A Libertarian Walks Into a Bear, The Utopian Plot to Liberate an American Town and Some Bears. It's written by Matthew Hungoltz-Hetling, and he joins us now. Matt, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Rick, thank you for hanging out with me this morning.
It's our pleasure, and thank you for this great book. I've really enjoyed it. Now, listeners, if you'd like to ask Matt about Grafton, or if you've been there, lived there, you've read the book, give us a call, 244-1777. 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Matt, it's a great book title, but what is the book about?
Thank you very much. So basically, the book is about the experiences that I had in the town of Grafton. I was there as a reporter for the Valley News, which you mentioned. So support your local journalism. It's important. Mm-hmm. It's basically how a libertarian social experiment called the Freetown Project that tried to create this little utopian society in the town of Grafton led to that town having some very unusual and extreme bear problems. And, you know, they're two very kind of like things that you wouldn't necessarily think of being grouped together.
Right.
But I found that there was a pretty strong link. So it was a really interesting, fun topic for me to write about.
And who came up with that book title?
Oh, I wish I could take credit. It was actually my excellent editor, Ben Adams, who is also lives in New England. For the publisher, Public Affairs.
It is gold. It's arresting. It gets everybody's attention. I'm glad because it certainly got mine, got me to read the book, and I've really enjoyed it. You mentioned, you know, that you would go to Grafton when you were working on the Valley News stories, but what really, kind of got you to think, this might be a story here, what's going on in Grafton?
Yeah, it was really funny. I went there to talk to a Vietnam War era veteran named Jessica Soule. And Jessica was having like an ongoing dispute with the VA over the extent to which they would make her home handicap accessible. Mm-hmm. Like basically she was in a wheelchair. She couldn't get into her bathroom. She's fighting with the VA over that. And she turned to the Valley News to help bring a little public scrutiny to this issue. And so, yo, I'm there in her house, kind of like chit-chatting, breaking the ice. She's got a lot of cats, and I had a cat, and I love cats. And so I started asking her about her cats, and she said, oh, yeah, you know, I used to let them outside, but that was before the bears came. And I thought, oh, my God, well, I've never heard anyone put that particular sequence of words together. So this suddenly sounds much more interesting than the VA. To tell me about the bears. And Jessica told me about this amazing set of encounters that she had with bears, some real heart-stopping, terrifying encounters, the first of which involved her being out in her backyard and a bear bounding out of the undergrowth and snatching up two kittens that were playing in the backyard at her feet, more or less. And, you know, she was helpless to prevent the bear from eating her kittens. And so that got me very interested in this question of bears in Grafton. And so I started asking her neighbors and other folks in town about their bear encounters. And over time, I came to see that there really was something going on there, that the bear encounters in Grafton were more frequent and more extreme than other towns that were set into bear territory. You know, it's not that unusual to have a town with a lot of bears kind of like around the edges, not here in this area. But Grafton was unusual. And so I started trying to figure out why that was.
Well, we're going to get more into the bears, but let's focus first on the town. So describe this little New England town of Grafton, New Hampshire.
Yeah, you know, in many ways, it is a typical small town. You know, it's got about 1,000 people in it. When the Freetown Project began, it only had two businesses, really. One was the world-famous Ruggles Mine, which had been limping along as kind of a tourist attraction after its use as a mine had expired. Mm-hmm. The other was their general store, which was, you know, converted into a gas station, one of these places that you see with the kind of off-kilter flooring because the building is so old, and, you know, the little glass terrarium with pizza inside it, that sort of a place.
Oh, yeah.
And that was it. You know, there were those two businesses. There was a very small collection of municipal offices. And there was a beautiful historic New England church. And other than that, it was mostly, you know, woods.
Now, Grafton seems to have kind of a history of a real libertarian streak. So give us some of that history, Matt.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that I loved discovering about the town was that the libertarian community, the national libertarian community, could have started the Freetown Project anywhere in the country, and they chose Grafton. And as I delved into Grafton's past, I came to understand why. Grafton, way back in Revolutionary War era days, was fighting against oppression from overbearing governance. At the time, it was King George, and they were fighting against taxes. You know, they didn't want to have to pay taxes. Mm-hmm. Who does?
Right.
But they really took that principle to an extreme. So much so that after the Continental Congress was formed, and the United States was just starting to kind of get going, and New Hampshire was really at the centerpiece of the revolution and this drive for a new country called the United States of America. Grafton, when it found out that it would have to pay taxes to the Continental Congress, voted to secede. And they made an effort to leave New Hampshire and instead join us here on the other side of the river in Vermont. They said, you know, we're going to join Vermont, which in those days was an independent republic and which did not necessarily have a place in the United States because Vermont told them that they wouldn't have to pay taxes here.
But they didn't go through with it.
Yeah. They didn't go through with it. They were put down by the military. Threats from George Washington prevailed. But ever since then, you know, there's been this kind of like sentiment that the United States government is in some ways like an occupying force, you know, that they are very, very focused on the local in Grafton. They don't like a lot of interference from outsiders, which is not an unusual trait. But again, they had this to an unusual degree. And they carried this kind of sentiment forward in the form of keeping taxes very, very low over the decades and centuries since, and in minimizing the amount of regulations. You know, Grafton is one of the few places in the area that doesn't have any zoning requirements. So you can build there regardless of things like fire safety codes or curb appeal.
So what's interesting, they like to keep things local, but there's virtually no place to shop locally there in Grafton to support locally. Matt, we've mentioned this a few times, the Freetown Project. So please explain what that is.
Yeah, so basically The idea was born in libertarian communities. They really wanted to have kind of a place to call their own. And this was to solve a political problem. There's never been a libertarian state or country on the face of the earth, and there hadn't even been a libertarian community. And so they said, you know, if we could really showcase our principles in practice and show people what it looks like to have a libertarian society operating, then other people would get it, and they would understand how great libertarian thinking is, and they, you know, we would grow our community. And so their ideals basically boil down to individual freedom is prioritized, which means that they want to be as free from taxes and as free from regulation and government as is humanly possible. And so they, after looking at a bunch of different places, decided Grafton was where it was going to be. And the basic idea was that they invited libertarians from all across the country to come to this little tiny town and set up camp there and live there and build a life there. And in so doing, take over the mechanisms of government by voting their own people into positions of power, and by fighting against taxes, and by changing the culture in various ways. And so in 2004, they did exactly that in Grafton.
Mm. Now, I mentioned that Grafton did have a long libertarian streak, but what did those who were already calling Grafton home think when the Freetowners started to arrive?
Well, yeah, the first reaction, it was really funny, actually, because the libertarians didn't tell anybody in Grafton that they were the new Freetown. and so, you know, it had been arranged in a private meeting with a Grafton libertarian named John Babiars, mm-hmm. who was the fire chief and has also run for governor of New Hampshire on the libertarian ticket a couple of times. And John, you know, said, yeah, this seems like a great idea. Come on in. And the people of Grafton only found out about it when somebody stumbled across a website that had been established for the purpose of promoting the Freetown to other libertarians. And the website was done by this real piece of work who went by the name Zach Bass, but whose real name was Larry Pendarvis. And Larry was a mail order bride business owner. He was very combative and really liked to be kind of a firebrand. And so his website that he created emphasized some of the most controversial libertarian policies possible. You know, it talked about legalizing the trafficking of drugs and the trafficking of organs. It talked about legalizing consensual cannibalism. It talked about legalizing duels between people who disagreed, and bum fights, which, if you don't know, is the practice of paying indigent vulnerable populations to engage in fist fights with one another for your entertainment and pleasure. So, yeah, when they start putting all of this stuff out there, and when the people of Grafton discovered that, they were pissed, if I can say that on the radio.
You can, yes.
thank you. They had a meeting, a big town meeting, and they, you know, a couple hundred people showed up, and everybody who showed up was opposed to the idea of the Freetown. You know, these were all the kind of more civic-minded Grafton people who were horrified at the idea, you know, not only that that these very controversial ideas were being floated, but also just by the very basic framing, the idea that a bunch of outsiders were going to come in and turn their town into somebody else's idea of a utopia. So they were really offended, very vocally opposed. And for a while, it looked almost as if the Freetown Project was going to be nipped in the bud before it began. But the Freetowners, they thought about it. And once the hubbub had subsided, they said, well, you know, sure, there were a couple hundred people there shouting at us at the town hall. But that means that there were, you know, what, 800 people who didn't come, who by their absence, we might gather, had some tacit support or approval. And so they kind of talked themselves into this idea that, like, the 200 people at town meeting weren't representative of the town. So they came anyway. And in fact, in a sense, they were correct, because once they arrived and started putting proposals up to cut taxes, they found a lot of allies from more kind of like traditionally fiscally conservative Republicans and conservatives. And so they did find that they were able to get a toehold in the town and start to enact some policies.
Yeah. So how did they make their mark in local government?
Yeah, you know, they put forward a bunch of proposals. Every town meeting, there would be a whole slew of things that they wanted to get done, and they fought against any increase of any tax dollar whatsoever. And so they did things like they cut the planning board budget by 95% and virtually hamstrung the planning board. At one point, they passed a measure to cut the town budget, the operating budget, by 30%, although that was overturned on a procedural error. So that most drastic cut was not enacted, but they did cut things to the extent that, you know, the town office developed, you know, holes in the window and had no working hot water, and the police chief, who was also Grafton's only full-time police officer, had to get up at town meeting and tell people that he hadn't been able to police effectively because his cruiser needed some repairs and he couldn't afford some repairs to make his cruiser road safe. So, you know, all the little budgetary constraints that we see in small towns across New England became very much magnified and exacerbated. And, the local library could only open for 3 hours a week, you know, during the work week. So Wednesday morning from 9 to 12, that was the only time that you could go during the work week to access the Grafton Public Library. So, you know, things started to go downhill pretty quickly from a financial municipal operations standpoint.
Yes, but Matt, were Grafton residents able to save taxes?
Well, you would think, Rick. but in fact, it was it's kind of a fool's errand. And in Grafton and elsewhere, and let me explain why. Like, Grafton has been operating on this principle that if you keep taxes low or reduce taxes, that will attract people. And people will come to live here because they don't want to pay high taxes. And that will allow our population to grow. And the more people that live here, the more people are paying into the pot. And so you can keep taxes even lower. Whereas other communities, and notably the neighboring community of Enfield, had a different philosophy where they say, we're going to make Enfield an appealing landing spot to live your life, not by keeping taxes low, but by providing appealing financial services or municipal services in the form of decent roads and a decent school system and infrastructure to support some businesses. And we'll invest in that historic structure to make Main Street a nice little place. And of those two philosophies, in Grafton, and you see it elsewhere, the idea of keeping taxes low does not work because people do not, in fact, come to live in those sorts of communities. And so what happens is your population doesn't grow, it flatlines or it even declines. And that means that you have fewer people paying the taxes, which means that every person has to pay more. Mm. So Enfield used to have the same population as Grafton. Now it has three times as many people, and so it's got a whole bunch of nice municipal services and community assets that Grafton lacks, and yet people pay just, you know, maybe something like 80 cents more in taxes a day for the average property owner.
Wow. Now, one big tax battle was between the town and a church. So what was the story there?
Yeah, so I mentioned that one of their nice historic assets in Grafton, the only community asset, one might say, was this Grafton Church, also known as the Grafton Center Meeting House. And so, you know, it's what you would think of, you know, steeple church, beautiful white clapboard, all of that. And the town had an opportunity to buy it, or actually not even to buy it. They were offered the building for free by the outgoing church. And the town said, no, we don't want to spend taxes to fix it up or to maintain it. You know, this is an expense that we don't want to take on. And so when the Freetown Project began, that opened the door for a factory worker from Stahl Chemical down near Boston to come in and buy that church. And he bought it for $68,000, which was a pittance. And he said, you know, I'm going to live in it, but I'm still going to call it a church. And he was a spiritual guy, but he didn't have any formal religious training, and he didn't have any formal religious credentials. And one of the things that he asserted very loudly right from the get-go was that because he was a church, he wasn't going to have to pay taxes. And so then the town gets into this big fight with this guy over whether or not they're going to pay taxes. And everyone's spending money on lawyers. The town's big worry is that, geez, if John Connell can declare himself a church, then everybody else is going to do the same thing. We have all these libertarians here watching and waiting to see what happens. And if he prevails, then they're all going to follow in his footsteps. So it really became a matter of high stakes for the town. And it was complicated because they said, you know, John, if you're a church, file with the IRA as a tax-exempt organization. Or I'm sorry, I said the IRA, but I meant the IRS.
Right.
And John Connell refused to do that because as a libertarian, he does not recognize the IRS as a legal authority. And so it turned into a big tug of war that ended very, very tragically in 2016 when one winter morning, people noticed smoke coming up from the church, and that smoke was indicative of a fire that not only tragically claimed the life of John Connell, but also severely damaged this historic asset where generations of Graftonites had gone to be baptized, to be married, and to be memorialized after their death. So the whole thing was just like a big debacle and a huge loss for all involved.
We're going to take a break here, but one of the problems was the fire department was so diminished because of lack of a tax base that the church burned and was badly burned. Matthew Hungoltz-Hetling is our guest this hour, talking about his new book, A Libertarian Walks Into a Bear. We're going to take a break right now for the CBS News update, then return to continue the conversation with Matt. Listeners to join in, 244-1777, 877-291-8255 are our numbers. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Spring is springing. There's still plenty of snowpack, so good reason to visit the Mad River Valley. While you're here, make a stop at the almost world-famous Warren's Store. Newly renovated, delicious deli offerings and world-class bakery. Online ordering now available. You must be ready to ditch those COVID sweatpants. We've got some cute, comfy, casual clothing upstairs at the Warren Store from some of your favorite brands. Free People, Z Supply, and Tribal, to name a few. Fall winter clothing is still on sale, so head on down to Warren Village. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. WarrenStore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. A couple of weeks ago, I had two Vermont authors on, Sarah Strohmeyer, Sarah Stewart Taylor, who had worked together at the Valley News before getting published. Well, this hour, I've got another Valley News reporter who is also a published author. What do they put in the water over there? Matthew Hungoltz-Hetling is the author of A Libertarian Walks Into a Bear, The Utopian Plot to Liberate an American Town and some bears. He's with us this hour to discuss the book. Listeners, if you've got a question or a comment for Matt, you can give us a call, 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. Matt, let's get back to the bears. We talked about them a little bit up front. Different people in the town took different approaches to dealing with or interacting with the bears. So tell us about some of those approaches.
The bears are one of the most delightful and at the same time frightening details of the story.
Yes.
You basically had a bunch of people living in non-traditional living situations because there was no zoning and because they were a lot of fly-by-the-seat-of-your-pants types of folks. They were living in yurts and shipping containers and makeshift cabins and tents and campers and mobile homes all in the woods. So you had these little camps scattered throughout the forests of Grafton, and they each had their own they were each managing their own food and food waste in their own way. And so bears started to take an interest in this, as you would expect a bear to do. Mm-hmm. And when the bears developed more aggressive or intrusive behavior, most people would call the state, right? Like you would call a fishing game or Vermont Wildlife and say, hey, I've got this bear. He's being a little too bold. And then they would send an expert out who would evaluate the situation and decide whether that bear ought to be, you know, euthanized or relocated, or whether perhaps the problem can be solved by somebody taking in a bird feeder or something like that. But in Grafton, they didn't want to call the state because the libertarian philosophy dictates that every person should be handling the problems in their own ways. And so they were each coming up with their own ways to deal with the bears. And some of them, you know, I talked to folks who put cayenne pepper on their trash so that the bears would come and get a snoot full of pepper and presumably run away. I talked to people who set booby traps for the bears. Talked to people who threw firecrackers at the bears' heads in an effort to drive them away. People, you know, used electric fences and left radios blaring and did all of this different stuff, most of which was non-lethal, most of which was not effective, and all of which over time served to change the culture of the bears that lived in that area and to just kind of make them even bolder. And this was exacerbated because in addition to the people who were trying to drive away the bears, there were other people who were attracting the bears on purpose because they just, for the joy of watching them eat, they would set food out for the bears and then just sit there and watch them for their entertainment, which is, you know, understandable. I would love to watch a bear in that sort of a setting, but it was ultimately damaging for both the people and the bears.
One was the donut lady.
Yeah, donut lady was one of the favorite characters in the book. She goes by that name because, yeah, I call her donut lady because she asked not to be named in the book, which I thanked her for agreeing to be interviewed and certainly granted her that anonymity. But Donut Lady is a dear woman of a certain age who thought the bears looked a little hungry, you know? And so in her soft-hearted way, she began feeding the bears, and it escalated to the point where every day, twice a day, at 8 o'clock and 4 o'clock on the hour, she would take two buckets of grain topped by sugar donuts out to a pre-established feeding place. And when she got there, the bears would be waiting for her. So it looked kind of like, you know, if you've ever seen somebody feed, you know, six or seven dogs at a time,
mm-hmm.
how those dogs will all kind of jostle for position. This is how the bears were. They were crowding around her and crowding around the feeding place so that they could eat as much as possible. And so she would be just within inches of them. And one interesting thing about these bears in particular is that they didn't hibernate because there was all this nice calorie-heavy food on offer, right? Yeah, why would you go to sleep if there's donuts coming at Donut Lady's house?
That's right. I don't sleep when there's free donuts around. Hey, let's take a call. We've got Marcia joining us from Barry. Marcia, go right ahead.
Good. Good morning.
Good morning.
I don't know whether this was a finding of yours or of somebody else who was doing studies of these towns, but one of them was that there was a huge rise in sexual assault and an inability to deal with the problem.
Let's check with.
I was wondering if that was part of your data.
All right, thanks, Marcia. Matt, did you find that in your research for the book with Grafton?
Not specifically sexual assault, but Marcia has the basic idea right. By a lot of measures, kind of like that fabric of life in that we all try to promote in our towns. You know, the kind of like civic responsibility and community pride. A lot of that began to unravel in Grafton. And so, you know, recycling rates went down. Crime of various sorts went up. I didn't talk about sexual assault specifically, but the number of registered sex offenders in the town tripled, which was certainly a concerning statistic. And there were some anecdotes, which, to be clear, is not, you know, scientifically defensible data. But there were some anecdotes of sexual assault and accusations, I guess we would say.
Hmm.
And so Grafton had never had a murder in living memory before the Freetown Project. But that changed when one young woman called her roommate a freeloader and he shot her and killed her. And then that same guy shot and killed their other roommate. So that was another kind of like consequence of the changes that were happening in Grafton. So there were a lot of measurable ways that you could look at the decline of the social fabric in this community.
Matt, you mentioned that a lot of the Freetowners lived in this encampment, which was an encampment for humans, not bears. Explain what that was like and what you thought of it when you visited it.
Yeah, you know, there were actually several encampments. I think probably the one you're talking about is Tent City.
Mm-hmm.
And Tent City was it was interesting in that, first of all, like, it wasn't necessarily for libertarians. But Grafton had become such a Wild West frontier town place and had such an anything-goes atmosphere and reputation that anybody who was kind of like anti-government felt like they could go there. And Tent City was a place I visited. It was absolutely bizarre in its appearance. I'll try to paint a little bit of a picture.
All right.
There were some odd makeshift cabins. There was an old carport that held the only generator in the camp. There were a bunch of tents, and the number of tents went up and down as the number of residents ebbed and flowed. And the leader was an anarcho-communist. So he was actually very, very much on the left. But he, too, found that Grafton was a place where you could come and kind of pursue these dreams of living a very unusual lifestyle. And so he and his buddies there, they set up this, we might think of it as a commune, although I don't believe they use that idea. And it was a place where, you know, one cabin or tent might have a Confederate flag, and then the very next one over might have a Bernie Sanders flag. And when the bear problems got out of control, they actually, ironically, these people who would come there to live a free life and assert freedoms wound up building a wall to fence themselves in from the bears. And so I always thought that that was so ironic that people had actually curtailed their lives to a far greater extent than government ever would in their efforts to protect themselves from the dangers that good partnership with government can solve.
That was my favorite part of the book, I think, and I had many favorites. Author Matthew Hungotz-Hetling is with us until 10, and listeners, to join in with your thoughts or your questions, you can give us a call, 244-1777 or 877-291-8255.
Hi, this is Nicole DuPont, and I'm the Hospice Volunteer Coordinator at Central Vermont Home Health and Hospice. Are you looking for ways to give back to your community? Central Vermont Home Health and Hospice is looking for hospice volunteers to provide critical supports and services to patients and families. Experience with hospice or healthcare is not required. All that's needed is a caring, can-do attitude and a desire to make a difference in someone's life. There are many opportunities to support hospice families from a safe social distance. We need your help.
CVHHH's Spring Hospice Volunteer Training begins Thursday, April 8th, and runs for 6 weeks. Trainings are held from 1 to 4 each week and will take place in person in Barrie with social distancing and other safety measures and via Zoom. Visit cvhhh.org for more information and to sign up.
Right now, we all might feel a little disconnected. For seniors living alone with smaller social circles, feelings of loneliness and isolation can feel overwhelming. But there's something we can all do to help. Connect with your older loved one virtually and have the conversation of a lifetime with StoryCorps Connect. Anyone can conduct an interview, and every interview will be archived at the Library of Congress, becoming part of American history. Connect, honor, share at StoryCorpsConnect.org/AARP. A message from AARP, StoryCorps, and the Ad Council.
Sundays on WDEV, a day like no other, with local news, sports, Sunday Swing Time with host Joel Nashman, and CBS Sunday Morning. Brought to you in part by Good News Garage, Vermont's original and local car donation program, accepting donated vehicles as tax-deductible donations and providing them to our neighbors in need. To donate a car and change a life, visit goodnewsgarage.org or call 877-GIVE-AUTO.
Coming up today at 5:30 on the Brady Farkas Show, I missed you guys yesterday. We are back on the air. We're reacting to the first day of the Elite Eight of the NCAA tournament. Former Catamount Hoops coach Tom Brennan will be with us at 5:45. We'll also preview day number two of the Elite Eight coming up later tonight. We take a look at the Patriots. Are we getting closer to a Jimmy Garoppolo reunion? And the Red Sox get some good news regarding Matt Barnes. Brady Farkas Show today at 5:30 on WDEV, AM and FM, and WDEVradio.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri, and we're talking about the new book, A Libertarian Walks Into a Bear, with author Matthew Hungotz-Hetling. Listeners, to ask Matt a question, share a comment, you can give us a call, 244-1777-877-291-8255, and you can always email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Matt, when did the Freetown Project seem to lose its mojo?
That is a great question. So what I found was that in 2016, there was a much larger libertarian social experiment happening called the Free State Project. And in 2016, they tried to kind of activate the Free State Project. And that sent out signals to libertarians from all across the country, and in fact, all across the world, that they were going to try to do the same sort of thing that we'd seen in the Freetown Project, but on a statewide level. They were going to transform the entire state into a reflection of libertarian ideals and principles. And so when that happened, even though you might think that that would actually be good for the Freetown, in practice, that kind of sucked the life out of the Freetown Project. The Freetown Project had always been the landing spot for any libertarians who were looking to make a difference in this kind of bold, exciting way of building a utopia. And once the Freetown Project came, libertarians that wanted to have that feeling of participation could go anywhere in Graft or anywhere in the state of New Hampshire. And so why would they choose Grafton? Grafton was full of bears, right? It had no municipal services. And so many libertarians, instead of coming to Grafton, decided to go to places like Keene that have robust communities and, you know, parks and well-tended roads and all that, all the sorts of things that could not get off the ground in Grafton, in part due to the actions of the libertarians themselves. And so after 2016, the movement in Grafton lost pretty much all of its steam. And it, there's still a few Freetowners living in town there, but business and purposes over and done with.
And how about the Free State Project? Is it going strong in New Hampshire?
Yeah, you know, I think they had a very headline garnering idea that they'd signed up 20,000 people, like 20,000 people had pledged to come to the state.
Over a number of years.
Yeah, over a number of years, right. And so, like, everyone kind of maybe expected this tidal wave to happen. In fact, it's been more of a drip, drip, drip. And so they don't have the raw numbers, the eye-catching raw numbers that I think they might have initially hoped for or expected. But they do have a very large, vibrant community, and they've very successfully made inroads into the New Hampshire State House. There are various Free Staters in who have been elected to the State House there, and some of them are even Freetowners. Some of them were firefighters who worked under John Babiarz in Grafton. And so they've really managed to introduce a bunch of statewide measures, including, you may have heard of, the flying car bill, the Jetsons bill, that allows flying cars to travel over the roadways without any additional state inspections or anything. And they're working hard to cut rules and cut taxes and privatize schools and all that sort of thing. And so they've really been advocating lately for secession. Which is funny because we started off talking about how way back when, in the 1700s, Grafton voted to secede from the United States. And now the Libertarian Party of New Hampshire recently adopted a platform plank advocating for the state secession from the United States. And so history is a circle, right?
It is indeed. Have you heard from any of the Grafton residents since your book has come out?
Yes. Some, you know, I've interacted with them a little bit. I found that even though I spend a lot of time in the book kind of poking fun at libertarians, I think my overall sense is that everybody – both libertarian and not, is a little bit silly, and I include myself in that.
Mm-hmm.
And libertarians are just kind of like one expression of the innate human silliness that is the burden of all of us to carry through our lives. And so I think they kind of get that. I think, yeah, that there's I do my best to, while being lighthearted and making fun and all of that, I do my best to also tell their stories and give them a little bit of a voice.
Mm-hmm.
And so they've been pretty communicative. And while they might take issue with an individual element or something, mostly the book has been well received, even within some of those libertarian circles.
Have you been invited to Grafton's library, which is about the only town service there, to do a reading? And if so, would you or did you go?
I have not been. I have been speaking at various libraries across the state. The Grafton Library itself, I would happily speak to their audience. I've been talking with the librarian there, but we haven't spoken about that specifically. So I don't know. Maybe you're planting a seed here, Rick.
I am. Of course, it would have to be on a Wednesday morning, but so you'd have a great crowd. What is
the voice broadcast from there?
Yeah. Oh, that's right. Hey, what is Grafton like today, Matt?
I kind of thought that the town might bounce back and make up for lost ground by hiking taxes and really investing in the town's future, but that hasn't happened. Last year, the town cut the budget by $7,000. This year, the town cut the budget by another $25,000. They're expressing concern about things like, you know, the town Christmas tree increased the electricity bill by $30. You know, there's this real continued sense of extreme frugality. And that has persisted beyond the Freetown. And, you know, I should also mention that Grafton, during the Freetown project, became the site of the state of New Hampshire's first wild bear attack in maybe 150 years. And since then, there have been two other attacks, both not within town borders, but in that same little area of New Hampshire. And so I think that that kind of like underlying libertarian keep to ourselves independent atmosphere that attracted the libertarians persists very much in Grafton, and I would expect it to make headlines in the future in some weird and unexpected way.
Well, if you do get to speak at the library, don't expect any gas mileage being reimbursed. I noticed one thing in the book, you know, and it's not, again, taking shots at anybody, but there are these wonderful bits of humor that you write in spots. I found myself just bursting out laughing. And was that intentional, or is that just the way you write?
Rick, that is so nice of you to say and call attention to. It is definitely intentional. I guess I kind of take the approach that there are a lot of very serious books about a lot of very serious topics out there, and I don't know that they necessarily achieve their goal of winning hearts and minds. And so my approach is to tell a very good, very entertaining story. Something that the main point of the writing is kind of like the narrative, and so that someone can have fun and experience these stories and characters as they go through, and then just kind of like sprinkle in the more serious stuff around the edges. People get it. They don't have to be hit over the head with it for 300 pages. And instead, let's tell them some good bear yarns and talk about some kooky characters and let folks enjoy that. And then they can draw their own conclusions.
And you are a member. We're almost out of time, but you're a member of something called the Order of the Occult Hand, and you have to slip in a certain line into a book or a story. Did I miss the reference in this book? I didn't learn about it till afterwards. Is the line in this book?
No. Thank you for asking about that. It's actually in a Valley News article. I would have to do some digging to pull it off or to direct folks to it. But yeah, it's like a very extreme example of what we call purple prose. The idea of something that's super flowery language. And the idea is that if a journalist can sneak it by the editors, that they get to join the Order of the Occult Hand. And I was, it was a great day for me when I saw that I passed muster.
Matthew Hungels-Hetling is the author of A Libertarian Walks into a Bear, The Utopian Plot to Liberate an American Town and Some Bears. Matt, thanks. It's been a lot of fun.
Rick, it's been an absolute pleasure. Anytime.
All right, take care. We're going to take a break for CBS News, and then we're going to come back and meet Vermont State Librarian. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Spring is springing. There's still plenty of snowpack, so good reason to visit the Mad River Valley. While you're here, make a stop at the almost world-famous Warren's Store. Newly renovated, delicious deli offerings and world-class bakery. Online ordering now available. You must be ready to ditch those COVID sweatpants. We've got some cute, comfy, casual clothing upstairs at the Warren Store from some of your favorite brands. Free People, Z Supply, and Tribal, to name a few. Fall winter clothing is still on sale, so head on down to Warren Village. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. WarrenStore.com.
Yeah. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. Think of some cool jobs. Librarian would definitely be on that list. Working in a library, surrounded by books. People coming into your place of business to read and learn.
Wow.
Now, what would it be like to be the state librarian? Sounds cool, in charge of an entire state's libraries, but I think you actually get to you sit in an office that's not in a library. Still, I think it's pretty cool. We're going to find out. We've got with us right now Vermont State Librarian. He is Jason Broughton. Jason, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you for having me.
Listeners, if you've got a question for Jason about what a state librarian does or about anything library-related, you can give us a call, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. All right, first of all, what does a state librarian do?
Oh, my goodness. we do quite a lot behind the scenes. So I am what would be probably known as like a silent librarian, because a lot of people, one, might not know there is such thing as a state librarian for their state. We are a group of people that are, of course, all across the country and U.S. territories, and we are known as the Chief Officers of State Library Agencies, or COSLA. But within that, our function is to try to make sure that libraries across the state, all different types, each state has sometimes their own unique focus, but within Vermont, the way it was written for our creation, which we are an old institution, was that we are to work and service as much as possible all the libraries. So that means academic. Public is our largest group, and we definitely pivot and assist the school librarians from time to time across the state.
Oh, I didn't even think about that. Yeah, that definitely does add to your roster. Now, realizing that they're never quite the same, what is a typical day like for the state librarian?
Oh, my goodness. So I come in very, very early, and my, I would say, regimen is to, one, find money. My goal is to find money for
you. Check the cushions around the office there.
Yeah. So, you know, in my case, I am speaking with the legislature on trying to understand what can be done to assist libraries in a variety of ways. And we also receive a lot of federal appropriation funding from what is known as the Institute for Museum and Library Services, or IMLS. We do have a federal agency that we connect with that provides a large share of our budget, and the rest is also general funds from the state of Vermont. From time to time, we will go after grants, and we have quite a lot that would be assisted. This, however, is a very unique year because of COVID, and so we do have some funding coming in, and I'm proud to say this because of our congressional leadership. Let me know and work very hard to have this. The Department for Libraries, of course, will be receiving $2 million plus to assist the libraries of the state, and we will be crafting a variety of grants and things to assist Vermonters, because a lot of Vermonters go to the public library.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Hey, we're going to go to the phones, Jason. Let's take a call from Rich, who's joining us from Starksboro. Good morning, Rich.
Good morning, Rick, and good morning to your guest. One of the responsibilities of Vermont State Librarian is the coordinator of the naming of Vermont place names and,
yes,
and localities.
Yes.
And in 2009, I worked quite diligently to have the location, the village of Grahamsville, Vermont, with an S before the word, the syllable ville.
Mm-hmm.
And Sybil Brigham was the Vermont State Librarian at the time, and the Vermont Library Board approved it and everything. I was told it would take maybe a year or so for that, all the mappers and people that work with place names to get that changed and updated. And I just went to Google Maps, and I searched for Grahamsville, Vermont, and it's not there. And it says, if you'd like to add that place name, click on this doohickey, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, I didn't. I thought I'd get on the phone and tell you about it. It's been 12 years.
All right. Rich, that's a great point. So let's start with, let's back up for just a moment before we get to Grahamsville, and explain the board that Rich is referring to, Jason, which is under your purview as the state librarian.
Yes, Vermont has a very unique, some call it quirky, aspect when it comes to geographic naming. I think we are the only state library in the country that has a board known as the State Board of Libraries. As part of its feature, it has two roles. One, the board is advisory to the state librarian, and they are wonderful board members that we actually have. And they do geographic naming.
Right.
And what that means is within the state of Vermont and a little bit out, depending on the geography, a person, a petitioner, can bring an item if something would like to be named or renamed. The process is pretty much the same, but it allows us to do some research with the petitioners and have a conversation, and we review it public in a meeting constantly, which is a public record and open meetings, where we will take some time. It can be done as quick as about maybe 6 months if everything checks out very nicely. And then our process is in parallel with the federal government. So we work with the USGS or United States Geological Survey. They are the ones that will take that information, also examine it, and if they agree, then guess what? You get put onto a federal map. And that primarily, now we don't name all things, we used to,
right.
But they've stopped that for a while. So in other words, once the transportation board was created, guess what? Roads and bridges went away from Department of Libraries, and a lot of people would find that interesting. But we still maintain geographic features, flora, fauna, and waterways and bodies.
Yep. So you're going to have to follow up with that board. And Rich, you might want to contact Jason after the show and find out what has happened, because I'm guessing, Jason, this was before you started with the Vermont State Librarians. And so Rich, get in touch with Jason and follow up on Grahamsville, because if it was indeed approved by the board, it should definitely be on maps everywhere. And we'll get that solved. And right there's another thing you can check off, Jason, that once that's done, you know, that you've accomplished as the state librarian, which I love.
That is true.
Now, before you went into library science, you were a teacher. Tell us about, you know, that career and why you decided to leave being a teacher.
Oh, my goodness. I loved being a teacher in a very, very unique situation. Life occurs, which I was not expecting. There are things when you age that you say, oh, I wish I had seen that coming, where my mother was diagnosed at the height of my career in education, because I was moving closer and closer into an administrative piece, where she ended up being told she had dementia. It's only myself and my brother, and within that, my brother made a wonderful, tearful plea to say, you need to come home. You need to leave Florida and come home. And I did, to take care of her and transition her. And I did so, though, at one of the times that even in Vermont, I understand that it was kind of rough here. So that was the first recession, like 2008, 2011, we were dealing with that. And I found myself kind of struggling to, because I was living off my savings. Thank goodness I was smart enough to do that, to find something. And I ended up, though, finally getting a job as a career and workforce development trainer at the unemployment office. And so I helped a lot of people do a lot of job searching and, believe it or not, writing curricula for them. And this was back in the state of South Carolina. That's where I'm originally from a little town called Cross. areas in Vermont think that they're tiny and small. Parts of Vermont have a lot more than what I grew up with, but it's very similar. I grew up with, you know, horses and dogs and farmland and grandfather. One of the things I can say on the record is that the Broughtons, the clan that I am associated with, is known for something very, very unique in the South. We are known as bootleggers. So we definitely love to make moonshine within that. So I'll just be quiet, but you didn't hear that from the state librarian. within that, though, I ended up going to a workshop at the request of a woman named Cynthia Hurd in downtown Charleston. And I got to know her very, very well. So over about a two-year period, she would always have me come back to talk to veterans and different people. And she sat me down one day, because we could just really sit and talk like how we're talking now. And she says, you know, I think you're confused. And I said, what? Where are you going with this? And she says, I really wish somebody had spoken to you about being a librarian as opposed to being a teacher. And I was like, there's money in librarianship. I don't know any rich librarians. How does this work? You know, they don't really make a lot of money. And that was my passion at that point because I was much younger. And she said, well, I have a job offer that I think you should apply for, and I still believe that you should go to library school. And so I ended up looking at it, and it was with the South Carolina State Library, one of our sister state libraries down south. And I connected with it, applied for the job, and was stunned. I actually got the job out of 500 people. Years went by, and she would still have me back. And unfortunately, for those who paid attention to the news, Cynthia Hurd, very dear, dear friend, wonderful woman, and almost like my person who told me to become a librarian, she was killed as part of the Charleston Nine by the gunman at Mother Emanuel Church. And so she is no longer with us.
Oh, I'm so sorry to hear that, but what a great inspiration to you to launch this career that's brought to you here to us as a Vermont State Librarian. Jason, you are Vermont's first African-American state librarian. Do you take special pride in that?
I do. I definitely know that the state is a very welcoming and open place to a lot of people, particularly like myself. And I do take pride that Vermont selected me. Governor Scott has that as part of his considerations, I think, early on, to have a diverse amount of people, particularly in the workforce. And so I am very proud to have been selected, because prior to that, I was the assistant state librarian.
That's right. And Jason, you attended two of the country's historically black colleges and universities, Florida A&M, South Carolina State. Why were they right for you, and what role do the HBCUs play in our education system today?
I would say a very important item, starting out very, very early for a lot of things. They do have a place in helping people connect sometimes when you, unfortunately, can't get into any other type of vocation. And that is not to say that it's low tier. It's sometimes very rigorous to get into the programs that you would like to get into, and an option to go, one, local, and two, close to home is very, very helpful. And number three, affordability stands for that. Now, yes, it does mean a few drawbacks when you talk about network and what it means to go to certain types of esteemed schools, but education is education. Even if it's a little bit different, one can have a really powerful and productive opportunity, because the goal really is about the individual. And I think myself included has proved that wonderful point.
Yeah, I agree. And Jason, we're now going to get some help from someone who I know has a lot of experience with the naming of towns. I think he's on the board now. Bruce Post from Essex is joining us, and always love when Bruce calls in. So did you hear our previous conversation about Grahamsville, Bruce?
I just missed it.
Right? Oh, okay.
All right. Sorry, I had to schedule a COVID test.
Not
because of any serious concerns, but I had to get one. So I'm listening to you in one ear and talking with folks at UVM in the other. So I missed the details.
All right. We'll let that go for now, but go right ahead, Bruce.
Well, first of all, I guess I don't have to give a spoiler alert now, because I am on the Board of Libraries and the chair. And first of all, I also thank you for having Jason on and conducting such a wonderful conversation. One thing to keep in mind, first of all, I'm a great admirer of Jason, and have been really privileged to work with him and speak with him regularly. Jason came here to Vermont when if you think of the state library and the Department of Libraries as a little ship, that ship over the previous 10 years had encountered some stormy seas, like state libraries and state library departments all over the nation had been actually, people were thrown overboard, if you use a metaphor, as they experienced tremendous budget cuts and downsizing. And that has happened to Vermont, too. And yet, the demands placed on the crew that's left are still almost the same as they were in the past and intensified in a very new way with the pandemic. And Jason has been a steady hand on the tiller of dealing with this, and I know he feels the same way I do. He is helped by such a great crew on board that ship. I think we only have 19 crew members left in the department, where there had been once over 32 or 33. And what a dedicated group of people providing assistance to state librarians all over Vermont who are coping with the challenges of this pandemic and yet trying to keep alive that spirit of our libraries.
Well, Bruce, thanks for that. And it brings up a great question about the role of libraries and how they've changed nationwide, but specifically here in Vermont, Jason.
I would definitely say that what people might not know is there's something called the Internet of Things, and Vermont has wonderfully been quirky with it. You had a commercial just on, and I know Almy at the Waterbury Library, and yes, libraries now have snowshoes, garden trials. You can get a Dutch oven in St. Albans. There are people all the way up in Canaan. There's things that you can now get, skis, shoes, a whole host of things that a variety of people would probably least expect that a library would actually have. So they have adapted, though, to community needs. And when we talk about that, one thing I'll say quickly is I did not say we do have an internal library known as the ABLE Library, which is the Audio Braille Large Print Electronic Resources Library, which is quite popular. And the goal of renaming it from the past name as a Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped to ABLE, which is talk about the service and stop talking about the population.
Absolutely.
You know, the disabled and the differently able, they know that they are this, so why not talk to them about how we're going to help them? Well, in doing so, guess what? In Waterbury, we helped Florella, that's her name, celebrate her 104th birthday, and she is a library patron for us.
Wow. Oh, that's fantastic.
She said she loves what we send her because we do have in-house staff to help curate and have a conversation with what people like and dislike, and we try to make it available. So, yes, we have our oldest Vermont is 104 in Waterbury, and she's a part of our service.
Oh, that's fantastic. Now, we talked earlier about some of your responsibilities. One is you worked with the, you had a role in the most recent census, and our listeners will remember, I loved every time your spot came on the radio and heard you, you know, imploring people, hey, you know, make sure you fill out your census. But now how does that work and fit in with the state librarian role?
Well, it just did. Sometimes you just have to make it work. But within that, it was not hard at all because it's information and particularly demographic information. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I find very, very helpful is librarians are all about information. There are people who have said to me, well, I thought that you guys like books. And I will sit there and say, no, actually, we like information. If I am caught reading at my job all day, I'd probably be fired by the governor, because that is not my role to just read books. Mm-hmm. It actually is to deal with information in a variety of forms. Well, dealing with the state's information of demography really helps, because what people forget is two things happen with the census. Number one, redistricting occurs for the state, and number two, our federal funds come to the state based on how we actually answered this. And so it was an interesting chore. We thought as a group that it would be already long, but that was when we were celebrating that we were doing this in January, mm-hmm. only for March to hit and COVID happened. And I never thought I'd be doing the census with COVID. We surpassed ourselves just a little bit, though, which was nice. In 2010, for the decennial, we had a rate of 60.3. And for 2020, we have one now at 60.5. That little bit of increase is hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Wow.
And could make the difference in redistricting.
Oh, I gotta love that. I want you to talk about, we only have a few minutes left, but the Vermont Public Library Foundation.
Yes, that was established early on. I did not have time to do, I think, all of the full research, but there was a wonderful family that wanted to donate money to libraries and to the department. And at that time, it was quite unheard of because the department is a state entity. Well, because of the size of the gift, I think it was about $20 million at the time, and this was almost like 15 years ago, it was so stunning that the state had to set up an item, and so the creation of the Vermont Public Library Foundation was crafted. We are retooling parts of it. It does not have the $20 million still within it. It has a couple hundred thousand, I think about over 300,000 within it, but we will be dispersing some of those funds out rather shortly as well, because it is a little bit hard for libraries right now, given COVID. And so we're looking to make sure that we have people remain with us and go forward within that. But the foundation accepts, so if anyone would like to be charitable, feel free to contact us and let you know how you can donate, and then we will assist because the money is for libraries.
That's great. And last thing I want to ask you about is the Clover system. What's that all about?
Now, the Clover system is what we have as far as our catalog, and we also, the library catalog that a lot of libraries are on, but not all of the libraries across the state. We also have things such as interlibrary loan. For those who might not know what that is, you can go into a library and search for items, and if your current library doesn't have it, it can be borrowed from a library nearby, and if it's not nearby, out of state. If it's not out of state, then it can even be international, depending on time frames for actually pulling it. But we have a lot of people that are utilizing the systems and access to search a variety of things across Vermont, and it can be electronic or it can be physical. And so people have access to our systems because we try to make them statewide and make it more affordable for Vermont communities.
Well, Jason, it sounds like you're still enjoying and have a lot of enthusiasm for the role as state librarian.
I do. I enjoy my job. I will say I get up each morning kind of like with a smile. That might sound kind of like comical for some people, like, oh, this is horrible. I get up and, you know, life is worth living, and it's enjoyable. It is hard. I'm not going to say it's easy. But at the same time, I enjoy what I do, but I really do it because I enjoy helping people find information that can actually possibly change their lives.
Well, I'm really glad that the hiring committee did not know about your background as a moonshiner, but it's out now. Jason Broughton is Vermont State Librarian, and yes, it is a cool job. Jason, thanks for telling us all about it today.
Thanks for having me. It was wonderful today. I appreciate
it really was.
So much. Thank you.
All right. Take care. We're going to take a break for CBS News, and then we're going to return to open up the phones. It's your chance to chime in with your thoughts this morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Spring is springing. There's still plenty of snowpack, so good reason to visit the Mad River Valley. While you're here, make a stop at the almost world-famous Warren's Store. Newly renovated, delicious deli offerings and world-class bakery. Online ordering now available. You must be ready to ditch those COVID sweatpants. We've got some cute, comfy, casual clothing upstairs at the Warren Store from some of your favorite brands. Free People, Z Supply, and Tribal, to name a few. Fall winter clothing is still on sale, so head on down to Warren Village. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. WarrenStore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. All right. What do you want to discuss? Yesterday, we opened up the 50 and older age band to get the COVID-19 shot. Have you registered? How was that? Or have you gotten your shot? How's it been for you? If you're not planning to get the shot, why not? No judgment. It would be great to hear from someone who's decided not to do it and get your point of view. You can give us a call, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. The phones are open till 11, and maybe you want to suggest a book, a future topic, or guest. You can tell us where you're jonesing to travel once this is all over. I just unearthed photos from trips to England, Scotland, Ireland, and Wales. That's my go-to. I love those places almost as much as I love Vermont, and the people there are just as nice as the people here I have found, and I can't wait to go back. So that is definitely on my list. And if you don't call, you may have to listen to my travel log from all my years of heading over to the British Isles. And I don't know how it's going to sound as a monologue, so but I do have some great tales. Again, our number is 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint at radiovermont.com. I did get registered last week, and I go next week for my first jab. And, you know, registering isn't that difficult. You don't have to be too computer savvy, but you do have to have a computer and be able to get on there. But what happens is the time slots just disappear very quickly, especially early on. You know, yesterday, over 19,000 people registered when the 50 age band came on board. Last week, the 60 age band came on board. Over 11,000 people registered that first day. You got to be patient. You know, you got to just know that you're not going to get registered today to go get your shot tomorrow. It might be a few weeks out, and you know, just be patient and do all the right things until and afterwards too, until we get this completely licked. The one thing we don't know, that wild card in all this, is the variants, right? And so we've been doing everything based on the original coronavirus, but the variants, who knows? But we're just hearing from the pharmaceutical companies that, you know, it should handle the variants as well. So, but again, try to behave, do your best. Our numbers are 244-1777. The toll-free number is 877-291-8255. That is 877-291-TALK. And we're going to go to Barry and talk to Betty. Hi, Betty. Good morning.
Yes, I just have a suggestion. I listened to the governor's time that he was on the air with you last week.
Yes.
And I just have a suggestion. I don't think it was very long, for one thing. I probably, he doesn't have that much time.
That's right.
But I would like to see him do a little bit more interaction with people, you know what I mean? A little bit more people can ask him questions on the phone or email, whatever the case may be. I feel that he did a lot of talking, but he did a lot of talking about the virus, which is fine, you know. I mean, everybody's interested in that. But we're also interested in other things also.
Yeah.
And I think he spent a lot more time just doing his, it's almost like when he does one of those speeches, his things on TV, he addresses people. I think he spent a lot more time doing that. And I'm one of these clock watchers. I watched, you know, maybe about 15 minutes he did that. And it was a very short period of time that he let people have questions and answers. You know what I'm saying?
Yes. Well, so he was on for a half hour. And when you take when you take the commercial breaks that we have, he was on probably for about 22 minutes total. So you're right about that, Betty. It's the first time in, I'm going to say, at least 6 months that he's been on this show. It's the first time since I've taken over in early November. And we hope to have him at least every other month, or maybe two out of 3 months, he'll be on with us. Now, on that particular day, since it was the first time, I did try to not take many phone calls while he was on that half hour, because I had the previous half hour, if you remember, open, and did ask people to call in then or email then.
Yep. Yes, I remember.
With their questions or comments. So I did work all those that I did get in during that time period. But you are right. You know, like any politician, he does have his talking points, and he definitely did use his time to get to his talking points. And we did concentrate mostly on the coronavirus and COVID-19 and the rollout and of the vaccines. And that is where I really did go with it this time. And so I appreciate your observations, because, Betty, you are spot on. You are absolutely right in what you heard and what you observed. So I appreciate that, and I appreciate your suggestions. And hopefully, you know, next time, vaccines and, you know, everything we're doing, hopefully – as time goes on, we have more time to get back into other issues that are affecting Vermonters. Right now, even the legislature, I guess you'll find, is so hyper-focused on everything COVID-related. And, it's...
Well, it has its place, of course. And, of course, it is at the front line. You know, that's where everybody is focused. But I also feel that, you know, we can do a little bit more conversation about other topics, too, because that is of interest also. But that was just my observation, and that's just an opinion that I'd like to see something in the future that maybe he could discuss other issues also.
All right, Betty, I think you were spot on. Thanks so much for your call. Yeah, she's totally right. Our numbers are 244-1777-877-291-8255, and I do – I think we're going to have the governor on again the last Wednesday of April – and then probably skip a month and then get him back. He is quite busy, not only in governing, but then these twice weekly news conferences do take a lot of time, not just the time that he's up there, you know, with his staff and laying out the latest directives, but also answering the questions. And so we cut out about 12:30. They go on till I think 1 o'clock. So it's a full 2 hours twice a week, which is a lot of time to devote to that, and then the preparation to be ready for there are new initiatives and also any questions that will arise. We're at 244-1777-877-291-8255. And who do we have? Nick? Let's get Nick in here. Are you ready? Oh, wait, he's getting him queued up. So we'll give Nick a break and see if we can get him on. It might be actually Vic from Middlesex. Let's take a look. All right. Is this Nick or Vic?
This is Vic.
Vic, yep. How you doing, Vic?
Good. How are you?
I'm great. What do you got for us today?
Well, I heard that lady, and I just wanted to reiterate that I agree with her 100%. I will be transparent here. I am not a fan of Phil Scott, Rhino, Republican in name only. But that's all he talks about is COVID. Now, maybe I'm stupid and not very paying much attention, but, you know, after a while, how much do you have to learn about, COVID? Kind of basic. You get a shot, you stay, you wear your mask, blah, 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 blah.
And, you know, Vic, I understand that. And I think every one of us definitely feels this kind of fatigue of having to hear about it, having to, you know, go by the rules. But when you look at the numbers of just this past weekend where we set a record with cases in Vermont, right? And you're thinking, this thing should be over by now. We should be well past it.
I don't think it should be over. But I think there's other things that are going on in the state, and for some reason, he does not want to address them.
Anything in particular, Vic, that you think?
How about our highways? I mean, from Montpelier to St. Johnsbury, it's like driving over a roller coaster in a mud bog. and several, any road you want to pick, 14, 15, 16, in the state of Vermont, he does nothing. And it's not just since COVID. I mean, he wasn't doing anything before that. They have a very, very poor policy.
All right.
That's one thing.
Good.
That's one thing.
Excellent. We'll talk highways the next time I have him on, which should be in probably about 3 weeks from now. So, Vic, thanks so much. Thanks for your call.
Hey, thank you.
All right. Great hearing from you. All right. Point well taken. We have been hyper-focused. And I'm going to say this. Vic is right. It's not just the government, but the media. We really have just about every interview we do. We have questions about, you know, the effect of the pandemic on whatever it might be. It is a big issue, and at times it might be that we really talk about that at the expense of everything else, and yet our lives go on. Things need to be fixed, and highways need to continue to be kept in great shape. So let's go back to the phones. We've got John on the line from Waterbury. Hi, John.
Good morning, Rick.
Good morning. Great.
Great. Hey, I had a quick question this morning. I could have swore I heard an announcement concerning the sale of WDEV from Ken Squire to another fellow, and I was just wondering if there was any amplification on that you could share with the listeners.
So it is a spot of a transfer of ownership, and John, I wish I was smart enough to tell you what that means. I think, you know, the best thing to do is to contact the business office and talk to our general manager, Steve Cormier, and he will explain exactly what that is. As a matter of fact, I think he's going to jump in here and help me out, which is the best thing possible. Hold on, let me get your mic on. Oh, let's do this.
Put my mask on.
Yeah, you don't have to. We'll be all right.
All right. Well, good morning, John.
Thanks, John.
Good morning, Steve.
Real quick, we didn't know this, but when Ken's power of attorney changed, we were supposed to tell the FCC this. And we found out through our legal representation in Washington that we had to make this announcement.
All right.
So Glenn Wright is one of Ken's best friends. I got to catch my breath. Running up the stairs.
Jump in and help.
I'm not 25 anymore. But anyways, Glenn is one of Ken's best friends. He's been his accountant for many, many years. He's his power of attorney, but he had a health issue, and it had to be transferred to somebody else.
Right.
When Glenn got better, it went back to Glenn, and we had to make that announcement.
Okay.
So, clear, I just want to make this clear. Ken Squire is the owner of the Radio Vermont Group. Today, tomorrow, people do not need to worry.
Okay.
Once again, I apologize. Man, I am out of breath. But well, nothing's changed, John. Nothing has changed.
Well, that's encouraging. It's good to see that the WDEV wellness program involves running up and down the stairs.
Someone better take my pulse right now.
You should have come up the front way.
You should have come up the front way. You know, going up through the mez, there's like several different changes in elevation.
Yeah, it really is.
Yeah. So hopefully that answers the question, John.
Yeah, no, that's great. I'm glad to hear. I'm glad to see Ken's improving.
Yeah, he's out, by the way. And from what I understand, he's going to make an appearance on the Dump Show this Saturday.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah. So he's out of rehab, and he's doing much better. Matter of fact, I got to spend some time with him yesterday morning, and he looks great.
When you said Ken is out, that was a big question. What does that mean, that he's out? But I you don't mean in that way. He's out of rehab.
He's out of rehab.
He's doing fine.
He's still the owner of the Radio Vermont Group. Nothing's changed there.
All right, John, great question. Thanks so much for calling us.
I'm going to run down the stairs.
Yeah.
All right. So, all right, thanks. We're still taking calls, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. I will mention this, that the steps that Steve Cormier had to come up, it is a warren. It's a maze like you've never seen, and you do feel as if you've changed. You need a Sherpa is what I'm saying when you come up this one direction of the from the building. I have, since again I'm, you know, probably in the same health class as Steve, I have now taken to coming up the front stairs, which one, aren't as steep, two, there aren't as many, and I even moved my desk to that part of the second floor here, so I can use those steps more often than the back steps, which really they give you a workout. All right. We're still at 244-1777-877-291-8255. How about that? Even when I don't have an answer, someone in the building comes rushing to my aid, which I really love. And that was really helpful to get John an answer on that. All right. Let's see. Yeah, we're still here. And you can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. I really appreciate people have been using that email to give me ideas, either show topics and or individuals that you'd like to hear from and to be on the show, because, you know, booking it is a lot of work, and I do appreciate getting your input, your help with it, so that we can bring on people that you want to hear from in the community. And we had a great interview last week about the state's registered apprenticeship program, something I didn't know existed till a DEV listener, wrote to me and said this would be a great interview, and it really was interesting. 38 different occupations where you can go through a registered apprenticeship program with the state. Someone has followed up to tell me of one in particular that I should follow up on, and we'll do that as well. So I do appreciate that. That has to do with apprenticeships. Just want to give a little time in between those interviews. All right, we're at 244-1777, 877-291-8255. And let's go to Newbury. Fred is calling. Hi, Fred.
Hey, morning.
Morning.
Hey, the big question now is, what is the best way to redistribute the wealth? Through capitalism or through the federal government?
That's a great question, Fred. We'll ponder that and try to come up. I know that's probably a rhetorical question, but we'll try to come up with an answer at some point in our lifetime. Okay, Stephen's next in Montpelier. Hi, Stephen. Go right ahead.
Hi. I was down at the Nature Center this morning.
Yes.
And they're doing incredible work down there.
Is this North Branch Nature Center?
The North Branch Nature Center.
Oh,
yeah,
I love
it's all
what
being
they
renovated. And it's just amazing. It's going to be quite a beautiful place inside the old farmhouse.
Oh, that's fantastic.
That Ike Brown sold years and years ago when it was a sheep farm.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went down there with my dog, Riley, and then walked back up Gould Hill Road.
Oh, I love it.
And then got home and had a sandwich, and then Riley went down and got the mail.
Wow. How did Riley learn to fetch the mail?
Well, I walked down and gave it to him, and
okay.
He walked back up to the house.
All right, so good. Riley doesn't.
And he got the paper this morning as well.
Well done, Riley. What kind of a dog is Riley?
Riley is a Springer Spaniel.
Oh my gosh, how wonderful! So the North Branch Nature Center. So what are the plans there that they're undertaking?
Well, they're doing a complete renovation of the kitchen, and then they're doing what we're calling the Seats Family Library, which is something that I've been working on for many years.
Hmm.
And they're building bookcases, and they put the floor down, which is a beautiful oak floor, and then they have canned lights in the ceiling, and then they'll have a conference table with all the electronics for conferences and chairs around, and also a screen for movies, and then there's the bird feeders outside.
Hmm.
And then in the lobby, they have three fish tanks, one representing the Cascades, all the organisms at the North Branch Cascades in Worcester, and at Worcester and Elmore, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other one is the a tank of all the organisms right next to the North Branch Nature Center. And then the third one is all the organisms at the confluence of the North Branch and the Winooski.
Oh, that's fantastic.
And I'm also working on the Confluence Park in Montpelier.
Oh, right.
And getting grants for that.
I love it.
It's gone from conceptual design to now it's going into the engineering phase. So hopefully next year there'll be a beautiful place for picnicking and the farmer's market and outdoor theater and kayaking and all kinds of stuff. And then we're going to try to remove the dams in Montpelier and the Pioneer Street Dam and the Main Street Dam so that can be kayaked from all the way up from, I don't know, the head of the Winooski down to the Bolt.
All right, Stephen, I got a boogie. I really appreciate this. I have to admit I have been a big fan of the North Branch Nature Center. I remember when they were part of VINS and then were on their own, and it was touch and go whether they could survive, and they have thrived through the years. What a great place. Chip and Zach and all the people over there, great to hear about what they're doing. Thanks, Stephen. That's going to do it. Danny, shut it down. That's our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is produced by Shayla Connor Shapiro, directed by Danny McGivergan, And our email address is vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Topics, guests, let us know. You can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading our podcast at wdevradio.com, and that's sponsored by the Warren Store. Fun, funky, and friendly. The Governor's COVID-19 Response News Conference coming up after CBS News. I'm Rick Singeri. I'll meet you back here tomorrow.